go. The question number one. Could you please, please not become enlightened for a long, long, long time? Out of compassion to the rest of the world and your disciples. I do not fear the end of the world, but I do fear a world without Ajahn Brahm. So could you please wait another 20, 25 rebirths at the least? Ah, isn't that very nice? My answer is no way. Dear Ajahn, I'm curious about the woman you told us about this morning who spontaneously slipped into the jhanas. Did she tell you about her life before this experience? Was she a meditator or have a near-death experience? Or was this an accident or brain chemistry and karma? This reminds me of the Zen stories where someone becomes enlightened by looking at a flower or hearing a sutra chanted. Thanks. No, she's just an ordinary girl. That's why it's so close. It wasn't enlightened, it was just the jhanas, but that's pretty close. Because the Buddha actually said that the joy you experience in jhanas, he's called it Sambodhi Sukha, enlightenment happiness. That's how close it is. It's not enlightenment, but it tastes the same, or tastes pretty close. Sambodhi Sukha. So she got really, really close there. Just an ordinary girl, just like you. If she could do it, surely you can do it. So that gives you encouragement. She did what I call like pressing the letting go button. Sometimes it's there, and sometimes people do it spontaneously. The thing is that when that does happen, sometimes people don't know what the heck has happened. So when you know what's going on and people explain it to you, yeah, it's great. So yes, it can happen, just that simply, that easy, just let go. So what do you do? Okay, I'm going to do this now. Come on, let go. Let go. I'm telling you, let go, let go, let go, let go. And of course, you know, that's not letting go at all. That's doing letting go. Dear Ajahn Brahm, when we are at home without a teacher, advice, can we meditate? Please explain how we go about questions. Come. No, when you're at home without a teacher's advice, you can't meditate, so stay here. Simple answer. Yeah, of course you can meditate at home, but you have to find the right opportunity for it. It's amazing. Sometimes when there's the Olympic Games or World Cup soccer or your favorite movie, everybody can find time to watch those things. But meditate, no, I'll do it tomorrow. So it really depends on what's important to you. So if you give it importance, it's valuable, then you'll always find time. And your teacher is in here. That's you. As a meditation teacher, I said on the first night, my goal in life is to get rid of you all. That's my goal in life. In other words, to teach you so much that you don't need to come here ever again. You can be independent. You know everything. You know how to get into jhanas, you know about enlightenment, and you know all my bad jokes. So why do you want to come back again? That's a trouble with you guys. Sometimes you have to come back and keep... This is a trouble. If you don't do it this retreat, if you don't get jhanas this retreat, you'll have to come back and it's the same jokes the next time. So that's the reason why I try to encourage people by torturing them. So in other words, just get out of the samsara. And any questions which come up, ask yourself what the answers are. And then instead of relying on other people, you can rely upon your own wisdom and be independent. That's the best teacher. I remember going to see this monk Ajahn Tate, one I respect highly. And I had all these questions, but when I went in for an interview with him, my mind went blank. And then what came up, I said, you know, if I do have any questions in the future, it's probably best I find out the answers myself. He said, yes, well done, that's what you should do. So tomorrow when you come for interviews, you ask me questions, I say, no, I'm not answering, find out for yourself. Is that a good idea? No? Okay, I won't do that then. How do you forgive yourself and others? It's easy. I forgave myself a long time ago. And others, yeah, oh, come on, you're not that bad. You know, I often find that even though I'd like to forgive and forget, the words I say remain only words. I don't perform the act, and I keep carrying the bad memory around. How do you make it reality, not only words you say? And how do you let things go when words are not enough? You've got to really feel it. And now you look at people, and there's some really naughty people, and they do really cruel things. But that's not all of them. The way to forgive, this is one of those teachings. When I used to go in prisons, and I still go into prisons every now and again, all those years I've been visiting prisons, I've never seen a prisoner yet. I've never seen a criminal. I've never seen a murderer. I've never seen a thief. I've never seen a rapist. I've seen people who've murdered. I've seen people who've stolen. I've seen even people who've raped. But I've never seen a rapist. If you understand what I'm saying there, the person is much bigger than their crime. Yeah, they murdered someone, but what else did they do in their whole life? Is that all they are? Just a murderer? No, they could be a milkman. They could be they could be a really kind person. They could work in these charitable organizations. They've done a bad thing, maybe 2 bad things, 100 bad things. They've probably done about 9 million good things as well. So when I go into jail, I never see a criminal. I see a person who's committed crimes, yeah, but not a criminal. And I make that distinction. As soon as you make that distinction, whoever it is really hurt you. They're not a murderer. They're not a liar. They're not a cheat. They're a person who's cheated. They're not a liar. There's no such thing as an adulterer. There's people who commit adultery. And when you make that distinction, you understand what I mean, then you see the person is much bigger than that terrible thing they did. And once you see how big they are, then it's very easy to forgive them. You see the other part of them, they're not that bad. In fact, I look at all these people, especially some of the people in jail, and just, they're a bit stupid, that's all. They just did a mistake. And sometimes you wonder just, well, I was in that position, that time, that place. You know, sometimes you do something or you say something, and sometimes you may just lose it for a few moments, and there you are, you're in jail for that. So easy, you know. So you'd be very forgiving, and you're very kind. And that way that, you know, when I go into prisons and I don't see criminals, I just see people, that's when they realise they're being respected. They see that somebody else sees them more than that murder they did. And then they might see that themselves, the other part of them, which is not a murderer. And that part of them grows and grows and grows and grows. So that's actually what happens. That's how you forgive. And forgiving yourself, it's exactly the same as that story I say that when I went to give a keynote at the Institute of Mental Health in Singapore a couple of years ago. They're having their anniversary, so I was invited to give one of the speeches there. And I told that story of the criminals, and not seeing a criminal, only people who committed crimes. And this head of the schizophrenia ward, he said, "I'm a Christian, but you did a great talk. Please come and bless my ward." So I went to his ward, and I asked him, "How do you treat schizophrenia?" He said, "I don't treat schizophrenia." And that really made me interested, because that's not what I expected. So what do you do? He said, "I treat the other part of the patient." And actually, I raised my hands up, because I really respected that. I said, "Wow, you've got it, you've understood how the mind works. If you treat the schizophrenia, you're saying you're a schizophrenic, and you find that grows. If you treat the other part of the person, they're recognizing they're much more than a schizophrenia. They're not a schizophrenic. They're a person who has episodes of schizophrenia. That doesn't make them a schizophrenic. If you understand that, you understand how healing happens, how forgiveness happens. Understand that, please. They're much bigger than any crime. They're much bigger than an illness. It's much more than that. Understanding that, it's very easy to forgive. And so we don't see a criminal. You don't see a schizophrenic. I don't see a cancer patient. I see a person who's got cancer. They're not a cancer patient. They're a person who's got cancer. They're a person. I see the person, not just the cancer. So they're much bigger than these things. So none of you are idiot meditators. I see many of you meditate idiotically. But you're not idiot meditators. Don't you get the idea? At what stage has healing occurred? Do you have to get to the jhanas or to nimitta, or does it occur before? And it occurs all sorts of times. Sometimes, just when you let go a little bit, Because, I mean, sometimes that we're so tight and stressed. When you really get mindful and you get aware of your body, you realize just what you do to your poor body. Really give it a hard time. And there's that tension and tightness in there. And you, instead of just relaxing it, you just force it. You know, instead of having a, I don't know how many people in interview times, I try to encourage, take a rest, go to sleep. No, I can't do that. Why? I don't know. I'm not supposed to, that's why. So I say, yes, you are. So take a rest. So get your body to feel really, really at ease and gentle. Remember the first thing which the Buddha did, you know, before he became enlightened, was take a good rest, have a good meal, middle way. Because that's one of his realizations. Once he realized the jhana was the way to enlightenment, that's Mahasatika Sutta, number 36 of the middle length sayings. Having tried all sorts of other things, he said, ah, perhaps that jhana is the way to Bodhi. And the insight came, yes, jhana is the way to Bodhi. Look it up, it's in Majjhima 36. And then he thought, well, it's very difficult to do jhanas with such a weak and tired body. Brilliant insight. You've got to have a relaxed body, a reasonably comfortable and healthy. And then it's easier to do the jhanas. You don't have to be perfect health, but, you know, just reasonably comfortable. It makes it much easier, which is why please look after your body. And then when you realize just, you know, how this body works, oh, you just really relax. And the nice thing about sort of samadhi is that when you are not, when you're out of the way, there's an old German saying which somebody told me, that when the cat's away, the mice dance on the table. That's a German way. I used to hear it as, when the cat's away, the mice will play. But in German, it's that they dance on the table. But that's the same thing. You know, they're happy mice when the cat's away. So when you're away, you know, this big control freak in your head, then your body can have a bit of fun and it can enjoy itself and it can actually relax and heal itself. But when you're always on its case, poor old body, it just doesn't know what to do. It doesn't have a chance to heal. So basically, you have to get out of the way. And then the body heals. Dear Ajahn, is meditation addictive because it is better than cross, cross, cross? It's S-E-X, come on, say it. Sometimes people wonder about monks, because I already mentioned the word shit word many times. I mentioned bullshit, I mentioned sex, I mentioned orgasm, and sometimes people complain. Ajahn Brahm, you should mention those words. You're a monk. Why not? Because the Buddha, and again, I quote these texts, I know what I'm talking about, Arana Vibhanga Sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya, again, the Buddha said, monks, you should teach the Dhamma in the local language. Enough said. But is meditation addictive? Yes, it is. So get addicted. It's a wonderful thing. And I mentioned earlier on, if you get addicted to the pleasures of meditation, there's only four possibilities for you. Not five, only four. You remember what the four consequences of being addicted to meditation is? Stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or full enlightenment. So if you get addicted to meditation, actually it's another thing which happens, which is not mentioned in those four. If you do get addicted to meditation, you tend to lose your hair. It makes you prematurely bald. How do you deal with the following? Tightness around the head. Just, you know, loosen the head. Energy centralized in the forehead. Just, I don't know, blow your nose. Is that a good thing? I don't know. Look, what's happening? If you've got that tightness or the energy in the forehead, it's number one to check that you're relaxing. You're not forcing things too hard. You're not wanting so much, because it could be tension. And tension comes from wanting and forcing too much. It could be because you're focusing on the tip of the nose and your eyes go cross-eyed. That's another reason why you get that tension and tightness around the head. But mostly it's because you're wanting too much. You don't know how to relax the body. The third thing, it could be just some energy which should really be in the mind. And it's just leaking into the body. I mentioned that to a few people. I think I mentioned it during question time as well. That when the mind gets very still and peaceful, you get lots of energy coming up, but if you've still got contact with the body, it tends to go into the body rather than into the mind, and it gives you these strong energies, but you know they're not very pleasant. You know, they tend to disturb the body. So what you should do is, you know, if the body hasn't gone away yet, when you're focusing on the breath, just the breath and nothing else, so the rest of the body is, you know, beyond your screen, just like the TV screen similarly. You can't see the picture on top of the TV set or the magazines underneath the TV set. You can't see the screen, or you see what's in the center there. So the TV, the picture above, the magazines below, and the frame of the TV has actually disappeared. The same way when you're watching the breath, everything else disappears. So you can't feel your legs, you can't feel your head, or your arms, or your torso. It's all gone. All you've got left is the breath, just like the center of the TV screen without the frame. If that happens, you're following the instructions, and any energy, it either stays with the breath or it goes into the mind. It can't go into your body. The body's gone. So the problem is we linger too long on our body. So when the energy does come up, it tends to leak into the body, and that's really not where it's meant to be. And so it's always a bit disturbing. That's the third possibility. The fourth possibility, you could have a headache, so take an aspirin. Can you tell us more about the knower? Can't really say much more. This is just your mind. This is the consciousness, the mental consciousness. This is this is the thing which can hear me, which sees, and which knows you see. It's a mind. Now, let's say one thing about it. You know the word in Pali for the mind is called mano. It's also citta, but mano is the other word for mental consciousness, the sixth sense. And it comes, it's related to the Pali word manati, which is to measure. And those two words, I mean, this is ancient Pali Sanskrit, they're related together, measuring and the mind. And when I saw that, I thought, hang on, there's a reason why those two are related, because that's basically what the mind does. It measures and thereby creates and controls. Because some years ago, people knew I was a physicist before, and they asked me a question. I think this was in Nolamara Center one evening, and it was a question which opened up a really big area of understanding how to meditate. Because they were quoting this philosopher-scientist, Lord Kelvin, one of the first presidents of the Royal Society in London, this prestigious scientific body. And he was one of the important people at the foundation of the Industrial Revolution in UK. And he's mostly known for the Kelvin scale of temperature, starting at absolute zero, minus 273 degrees centigrade, where nothing moves. That's the lowest temperature. No energy left there. But anyway, he once said, you know, the beginning of technology, he once said, the only way we can control nature is to learn how to measure her accurately first. He had the insight, if you're going to start to make things work, you have to measure things. So you have to have standard weights and standard linear measures. Now, in clocks, we could tell the time accurately. And so the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, you know, really depended upon having these standard measurements and being accurate in your measuring. And once you could do that, technology just took off. And they asked me once, what did I think about that? And of course, you know, I always tend to turn things backwards. And I said, well, that's very interesting, because it's true. If you want to control things, you've got to measure them first of all. So what if you don't measure things? Then you can't control anymore. Have you ever noticed how governments try and measure you so they can control you? Have you ever noticed how you measure other people? That's a friend, that's an enemy, that's somewhere in between. That's I like them, that I don't like them. Because once you start measuring and judging them, then control happens next. There used to be this myth in medieval Europe, if you knew someone's name, that you could have power over them. If you could measure something, you could control them. And that was actually a fascinating idea, and you play with that, and you realize when you don't measure things, you have to let them go. They're out of control. So what do you do with your meditation? Stop measuring it. No good, no bad, no peaceful, no sort of agitation. It's all very good. Or good enough. Poor D. So when you stop measuring your meditation, you can't do anything anymore. You're totally disabled. You have to let go. So that's another thing which is lovely to do in meditation. You sit there and just no measure at all. I don't know whether this is peaceful or whether this is agitated. I'm not even going to measure it. And because of that, you can't react. You can't sort of control it, because if it's like agitated, you've got to do something with it. I've got to settle it down. And you're doing something again. And if it's peaceful, I want it to be more peaceful. And again, you start to twiddle the knobs and do things again. That's a problem, because you measure first, you assess, and then you do. So if you stop assessing, stop judging, just be with this moment as it is, just be happy to be here, you find you stop all this doing business. And then you start to meditate. Wow, it gets very peaceful. So it's all about letting go of doing, by letting go of measuring. The problem is, though, when you start letting go of measuring, you disappear. The main reason for a mind to exist, to measure, to know long and short, it disappears. So your mind is vanishing, and with it, who you think you are. You are the measurer. You've been measuring all your life. And imagine you stop. That's freaky. That's scary. Because when you stop measuring, you can't control anymore. When you can't control, you feel very, very insecure. But actually, the more you let go, the safer you are. So the mind is the measurer. That's why in Pali, the words are related. Basically, mano is the noun. And what the mind does, the verb is manati. It's what the mind does, measures. So when you stop measuring, the mind stops. That's freaky, but it's great fun. So there we go. That's deep stuff. You think that was profound? You've been measuring again. Shut up. Number Ajahn, what is Mara? Aha. Mara is the beautiful guy. He's really got a bad rap. Mara, now this is, Mara is supposed to be, you know, the nearest they get in Buddhism to a devil. He's like the tempter. He's the guy. So I don't know why they call it a guy, but actually his daughters were all females, so you know that's gender neutral. But this guy was the guy who came to see the Buddha just before his enlightenment and tried to sort of do a deal with him. Say, don't get enlightened. You could be this great leader of mankind and womenkind and gaykind and everybody kind. You can do so much for the world. You've got such great powers. If you become enlightened, you're just going to leave after a while. That's no good. Stay around and stop all the wars and the famines and let people be living in peace and harmony. You can do that. And the Buddha said, I know you, Mara. Get out of here. Because the word Mara, what really made me understand what Mara is, that Mara is a god, a deva, who in the Buddhist pantheon, you know, the Buddhist hierarchy of heavenly realms, is the boss, the head, in the realm called the Paranimitta Vasavati realm, the realm of those who wield power over other people's creating. This is the control freak in chief of the universe. Above him is the Brahma realms. They're just into love and kindness, and really refined. They're not into controlling. No, those guys are into forgiving up in the Brahma realm. But Mara, he is a controller. That's why he wanted to control the Buddha. Why didn't you let the Buddha become enlightened? No, because then he's out of my control. And that's what Mara is. He's a control freak. Now, do you know that Mara inside of you? That is a control freak inside of you, come on, stay up late tonight. Come on, tonight I'm going to do it. I'm really going to get John's tonight. That's Mara. Sort of, that guy in that room next to me who keeps banging the door, he's left his door up, I'm going to sneak in there, I'm going to lock it, and I'm going to put glue in his hole so he can't get in there. That's Mara again. You're controlling other people. Those who want to sort of get the crows and shoot them because they poo by the windows. That's Mara. They're controlling. That's what crows do. They poo. So that's Mara, the control freak. When you saw that, you understood why he's the bad guy in chief. Controlling is the enemy. This is fascinating because for us, the controller is our will. Will is our friend. You know, we can choose to do this and choose to do that. And we think the will is our closest ally. All we need to do is to teach our will to be a bit smarter. Because we made bad choices in the past. We don't want to give up choosing. We just want to make the choosing smarter. And that is the myth. That's all Mara. I know you, Mara. So instead of trying to make the will smart, you realize the will is your enemy. You let it go. No will. Otherwise known as letting things be. Contentment. Freedom. Happy to be here, no matter where you are. Letting go of desire. And when the will disappears, then you're in jhanas, having a nice time. And then you realize what created all of this trouble and suffering to begin with. Control to control, control. You know, in the suttas, that's where the Buddha said, when you get into jhana, it's blindfolds Mara. Mara can't find you in there. It's beyond control. Letting go at last. So that's actually why these jhanas, they give you a taste of what it's like to be beyond Mara's reach. It gives you the insight from direct experience of how to get beyond control. So, when I get into deep meditation, I'm out of control. Peaceful, blissed out at last. Bye-bye. But it's tough to do that because you have to let go of something you cherish more than anything else. Yeah, you may be able to let go of your body. You may be able to let go of all your knowledge when you get demented. You may be able to let go of all your possessions. But to let go of the doer, the will, that's one of the toughest things. You know how you do that? You're getting so deep in meditation, it's just too much fun. That's what happens to you. You know, you get like the simile is like you're on the edge of jhanas. And you can see that's bliss, this is wonderful, it's profound, it's important. You know it's just, you can have a great time there, and it's the sort of thing which you've been aspiring for. It's not just pleasure, it's profound, it's pregnant with so much wisdom. It's deep stuff. But to get in there, I've got to let go of all my doing. Let go of my will. That's most of what I think I am. But it's just so nice. But the sacrifice is too much. But it's brilliant in there. But no, I'm attached to me. But, I'm going for it. It's a joy and a pleasure. In the end, it just drags you in. You can't resist it. And then you realize this attachment to the doer, the controller, the will, the me. That was the biggest enemy of you. You have wonderful times when you do nothing. And when you realize you're not the controller, that's when forgiveness becomes very easy. Who's there to blame? Not me, it's not my fault. I am totally innocent of all the bad jokes I keep on repeating every time. Totally nothing to do with me. I take no responsibility for that. Just my stupid will, that's all. Come on. So anyway, do you have any advice for meditating with tinnitus, please? Yes, tinnitus is when you've got ringing in the ear. So you can screw your ears off. And wouldn't it be wonderful if you had ear lids? And you've got eyelids. And close your eyes and don't see anything. If you had ear lids so you could stop hearing things, it'd be brilliant. But anyway, that's not been invented yet. So, the thing is, if you've got tinnitus and you try to control it by getting rid of it, it gets worse. So instead, just make peace with the tinnitus. Be kind. Oh, nice, tinnitus. Thank you for sort of coming to visit me. And be just really gentle with your ears. And then you find it's not so much of a problem. As you all know, with sickness or with any other disability, it's what we how we react to it causes the major part of the difficulty. So if you've just got tinnitus, let it be. In such a still environment, the rushing sound in my ears is deafening. I try not to disturb it, let it be, but it's not easy to maintain. Thank you. But it's not easy to maintain, but you've got no choice. You have to do that. And that becomes your good fortune. Because you have to learn and let go, that's why it becomes Ajahn tinnitus. It becomes your teacher. You learn so much from it because you've got no choice. I've known a lot of people. It was this guy who was years ago. No, Rodney remembers him. He had this very, 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 very bad back. So much so that he would go to this pain clinic in Perth, in Osborne Park Hospital, where he told me any medication was allowed, any drug, because his pain was so bad. There's nothing illegal for him. And he said that the pain clinic, you know, for people with chronic, really extreme pain, one of the things they taught him was how to describe his pain to others. Because they could put like an MRI scan on your brain and actually see what it was doing to your brain and compare it to other people's pain. And he said, what you could objectively measure that pain, he said, was like having your leg sawed with a saw. He said, that's what it felt like all the time. It's the same thing which happened to his brain. So if they took me and they were sawing my leg off, there'd be a certain part of the brain lights up to a certain intensity, and that's what part of the brain was lighting up for him. Incredible pain. And it was constant, chronic. But he came up to me and he said, I've finally done it. So what have you done? And you know, my meditation, I finally got the flat line. I said, oh, on the ECG. He said, no, that was easier. Did that a few months ago, on the EEG as well. So just now he could get his mind, his brain, so still it was flat line. And then he turned around and said, see all those people sitting in the back? They're all the doctors and nurses from my unit. They're coming to figure out what the hell's going on in this place. But he could only do that because there was such enormous pain, he had no choice. He really had to meditate deeply. He really had to let go. Otherwise, it's intolerable. So sometimes, if you have any disability, sometimes you can turn it to your advantage because you've got no choice anymore. You can't be lazy. You can't just go and sort of, you know, think about sex or the future or soccer or whatever else you think about. You really have to get your act together. So that's what he did. Good on him. Ajahn, is masturbation breaking the five precepts? In the hall, it should not be done. Nor should mental masturbation be done. That's the worst part. Mental masturbation, thinking about all sorts of weird stuff. Thinking. But is it breaking the five precepts? Actually, it's not really breaking the five precepts, but just because it's not breaking the five precepts doesn't mean it's a good thing to do. And right, because sometimes, like, people always try and make excuses. When I first went to Thailand, I was really quite surprised. Because all these devout Buddhists, they were catching fish. Now, all these people who would, you know, look after Ajahn Chah and just go and take the five precepts every week, you know, there's close disciples, they'd all be fishing in the paddy fields and the rivers. And when I first said that, I said, you're breaking your precepts. I said, well, are we? I said, yeah, you're killing fish. They said, no, we're not. We're not killing the fish. We just take them out of the water and they die by themselves. And that's what they used to say. So be careful. You can always find an excuse, you know, if you're sneaky enough. So anyway, it's very good because every now and again someone puts a curly question in there just to have a bit of fun. And thank you for doing that. It makes life interesting for a monk. I'm young, healthy, I've got a good job and boss. I have beautiful house and family. How could the first noble truth apply to my life? I can't see any suffering, dukkha at all. Yet. That's what it's like. Life is going rosy and happy and got a good job and house and family. There was this story I remember reading. It was actually, I think, in the Time magazine while I was in Thailand. There was this guy, it's a long time ago, 60 or 70 years ago, and he made a fortune on the stock market in the US before the Depression. Made a huge amount of money. And he saw the Depression before the Second World War coming. And so he cashed in all of his shares. You know, when everybody else lost their money, he cashed them in. And then, you know, he was made for life. He didn't have to work anymore. And so he thought, he was smart. He said, why live in the United States? There's a whole world out there. So he went to the public library and he researched, you know, the most idyllic place to live. You know, climate, to make sure it's a really nice climate, not too many mosquitoes or other creepy crawlies. A stable government, so there wouldn't be these coups and stuff. Plenty, enough money, but not too much money there, so he could, you know, get servants to look after him and cooks. You know, a nice sort of culture in which he was going to live in, nice, peaceful, good people. And he chose this place after lots of research. A little island in the Pacific, which no one had heard about. Idyllic. And the name of the island was called Guadalcanal. Those of you who know your history know that it became famous because there was two major battles during the Second World War. And for him, when he chose that place, he didn't know there was going to be a big battlefield. It was this insignificant, idyllic, paradisical island in the Pacific, in the Solomon Islands. Really nice people, just those simple sort of islanders, you know, great culture, you know, plenty of food, you know. They didn't want for anything, and it's this idyllic climate and so rich in resources. And that was his heaven. So even when it's perfect, you don't know whether a big battle is going to happen next week. So that's the trouble. Sort of, you know, the ideal was always temporary. You're very lucky. Well done. Enjoy it. But remember, it's subject to falling apart at any moment. That's why you have the Four Noble Truths. So yeah, you're having a great time so far. That's because you made good karma. Well done. But remember, keep on making good karma, otherwise it won't last. During the time of the Buddha, many of his disciples got enlightened upon hearing his teaching. How could it be possible? You've heard so much teaching. How many people are enlightened yet? I've been teaching for years. How many people have been enlightened? Not that many. Oh. But the reason, obviously, the Buddha was the most powerful teacher. So when he taught, it really got deep inside of you. And also in those days that people were doing a lot of meditation, a lot of jhanas. Look, I don't mind saying, one of the reasons people don't get enlightened these days is because they downplay the importance of jhanas. They think you can become enlightened without jhanas. And that's one of the reasons no one gets enlightened. And I say that because you get a jhana, you experience what it's like and you realize its importance. You know, it's how powerful it is. You'll kick up the backside. The powerful thing to stop all those conditionings, to see the nature of the mind, to see this doer, this knower business, to see none of this is going to last. Powerful, deep experiences. That's one of the reasons. In the Sangyutta Nikaya, the five causes for the decline of Buddhism. Disrespect to the Buddha, disrespect to the Dharma, disrespect to the Sangha, the monks and the nuns. In many places they try and dispense with the monks and nuns and think lay people can teach. That's the third reason for the decline of Buddhism. The fourth is the despising the training, in other words, precepts. I don't need five precepts, do whatever you like. And the last one is disparaging samadhi. Sama samadhi is jhana, disparaging the meditation. The jhanas. Those are the five causes. So disparaging jhanas is one of the five causes for the decline of Buddhism. That's why I really go out on a limb saying they're important. we go. How does the mind process things and function if you let go of all thoughts? Exactly, it doesn't process things. It gets out of the way. You've been processing things for too long. That's the cause of all the problems. Stop it. If forgiving ourselves can really erase the fruit of karma, then what about people who don't know whether they are doing bad things? For example, a child who kills a mosquito and does not know that he did something bad. He thought killing a mosquito was okay and hence no hard feelings or guilt. That child going to get the fruit of karma for killing those mosquitoes? Not probably. If he does, it gets very small good karma because the intention is the most important. If you really know what you're doing, that's why they say, like if a monk or a nun breaks a precept, you know, we get it double than what you get. They say it, and the simile is, if you're riding a horse and fall off, you don't fall so far. If you ride an elephant and fall off, that's a long way. You really break a few legs. And he said, that's like the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. We're like high on the elephant. So if we break a precept, if we make a mistake, that's much worse karma than if the same mistake was made by a layperson. We're riding the elephant rather than riding the horse. That's why as monks and nuns, we have to be very careful to keep our precepts. Little kids, you know, they're not even riding a horse. They may be riding the dog or the skateboard or whatever. So they fall off, it's not so bad. Because, you know, their moral sensibility hasn't been developed yet. They don't really know what they're doing. They don't realize it's good or bad. Therefore, the intention which causes the karma is not that strong. In Singapore and many other places in the world, there is this famous temple of Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva. Unlike other Mahayana tradition temples, they got these chopsticks for fortune telling. What they do is shake the bottle full of chopsticks and silently ask their question to the god or goddess, especially to Avalokiteshvara, for guidance and expectations of the future. And sometimes it is very accurate what the chopsticks number represents. My questions are, really ask the gods or goddess for our future? Can they really do it? Look, they've got much better things to do than just to, you know, answer your questions about whether you're going to marry that girl or another girl. And if they were really accurate, you know, why was Singapore caught in the GFC just like every other country? You know, didn't the government, didn't the Prime Minister go to the Avalokiteshvara temple and actually ask the gods and goddesses for what securities to invest in? If it worked, people in Singapore will all be well and happy and richer than other countries. They're not. They're the same as anybody else. So what it really is a bit of wishful thinking. When it works, you remember it. When it doesn't work, you forget it. Which is one of the reasons why that psychologically, you know, fortune telling, we always say, oh, it works, it works, it works, it works. Because one time out of 1,000 it does work. The 999 times it doesn't work, that's when we don't even just remember that. So be very careful of fortune telling. One of the old stories, and it's a classic one, was the guy here in Perth who had the dream of the five angels. For those, how many of you remember that story? If you all remember, I'm not going to tell it. How many of you remember the five angels story? Why is that? Only a few of you. Okay, I can tell it then with impunity. There's this guy in Perth some years ago, and he had this dream. It's one of these, you know, prophetic dreams, really clear, where it tells you the future. And it's one of these really good dreams, because he dreamt of a horse race. Now, they're really good dreams, especially remember the name of the horse. And, actually, it wasn't a horse race, sorry, no. He dreamt of, it was just another dream. He dreamt of these five angels. And in his dream, these five angels lined up, and each one of them had five pots of gold, like jars, you know, full of these gold coins. And they presented it to this guy. 25 pots of gold, worth a fortune. And just as he received the last pot of gold, you know what it's like in a dream? That's when you wake up. And he's wake up, he's in his bedroom, and first of all he looks if there was any Davids, there was no heavenly beings there, but worse, there was no pots of gold. That really disappointed him, it was only a dream. So he got up, and he went to the toilet, then he went down for breakfast. But that morning he found his wife, for some inexplicable reason, had made him 5 pieces of toast and 5 boiled eggs. And he looked at the newspaper, it was the 5th of May, 5th day of the 5th month. 5 eggs, 5 pieces of toast, 5 angels, 5 pots of gold. So he thought that, this is some sort of omen. So he looked at the horse racing. And there's a horse racing course here in Perth, named after one in England called Ascot. A-S-C-O-T, 5 letters. So straight away, he looked in race number 5 that afternoon at Ascot, and he couldn't believe his eyes when he saw that in race number 5, horse number 5 was called 5 Angels. What would you do if you saw that? You only get these opportunities once in a lifetime, if you get them once at all. So he took the afternoon off work. He never told his wife, because sometimes girls don't understand these things. And to keep the lucky number 5, he drew $5,000 out of the bank. If you're going to win, you might as well win big. $5,000 out of the bank. And he went to the racetrack, and he chose the 5th bookmaker in line, and he put $5,000 to win. Horse number 5, race number 5, 5 angels. The lucky number 5 couldn't be wrong. The lucky number 5 wasn't wrong. His horse came in 5th. So that's the other problem with getting signs or getting fortunes told. Actually, you get the information, but you don't know what it means until after the event, when it's too late. So it's just a waste of time. The people who actually really do win, sometimes it does work for the temple. They make a lot of money out of that. So people who tell fortunes, the only ones who really win are the fortune tellers. They always win, because they charge a fee. You guys are the ones who always lose. I've heard that when people die, they experience out-of-body thing, but at the same time, the Buddha said that with the flick of the finger, a person who dies is born again already. So what does this mean? Does every person always rebirth as demons or angels first before they rebirth again to their human animal forms? It's just really terminology. So when you die, you get reborn as this out-of-the-body person. Yeah, it is an instant rebirth, sort of, but it's also just you experience it as leaving your body, floating out, and actually seeing what's going on around. So that's just standard. You can read so many descriptions about that, of out-of-the-body experiences. When you leave your body, call the Manomayakaya, and you can go and listen to what's going on. There's one guy, he's actually dead now, but he could leave his body. He's a Burmese guy. He could leave his body at will. He had very strong samadhi, and he could leave his body at will. And he said once he was working up in Darwin. He was an air-conditioned engineer. He got a contract up in Darwin, and his wife was back here in Perth. And he never trusted his wife. He used to come and visit her. not going on a plane, just get out of his body and just go and visit her. And that she knew when he was around. She could feel him because it was his wife. He said, Keith, go back to Darwin. I'm okay. I'm a good wife. Get out of here. But he'd still go and check out on his wife. And there's this other guy. He was up in the prison up the road in Karnat. This was Yugoslavia, before Yugoslavia broke up. And he said his experience was he was a kid, maybe 6 or 7 years of age, and he was having an operation. On the table, he died on the operating table and sort of floated out of his body. He was only about 6 or 7 years of age. And he saw the doctors operating on him with his body cut open. And he'd had no knowledge about medicine, he was only 6 or 7, but he knew the doctors were looking at the wrong place. They weren't seeing the cause of him, his big problem. And he said he just willed the doctor, to look over this part of the body where the problem was. And as soon as he made that thought, the doctor turned his head and said, "Oh, we've got this is the problem." And they could fix him up and he came back to life again. So he got back in his body. He said from that time on, he could always leave his body at will. So he said to me, and he was actually serious about this, he said, "I don't mind being in prison. I can watch the movies every night. They can't stop me. I just leave my body and go to the theatre and just hang about there, and I can see all the movies for free." So there are some advantages of being able to leave your body. For those of you here, if you leave your body here, you can just go watch a movie and I can't stop you. I've learned in Buddhism that people who reach jhana in their meditation, when they die, will get rebirth in the Brahma world, the Rupa Brahma or the Arupa realm. So it's kind of a guarantee that if, let's say, a person who reaches jhana in one of his many meditations just once and never reached jhana and meditate very much until the end of his life, be reborn in the Brahma world. Not always. Look, if you get whatever you incline towards in this life, that's where you get reborn. So it just depends on what your inclinations are. So if you get jhana once by fluke and then you just end up in the pub for the rest of your life, you're not going to get into the Brahma realms because, you got jhana once, but you've blown it by just wasting the rest of your life. But if you do lots and lots of jhanas, this is what the Buddha said, lots of jhanas, and so it becomes an inclination, then you get reborn in those beautiful realms if you get reborn at all. Or if you get a jhana close to the end of the life, But remember, all the other things in your life are also really, really important. You can't just think that just one or two things you do are going to make that much difference. In the same way, this is another of those stories I tell every retreat. There was a Sri Lankan man, another Waisak Buddhist, and he would only go to the temple. Because I was told this story by a Sri Lankan guy. He'd only go to the temple on Waisak Day, and it's only because his wife would nag him if he didn't go. So he reluctantly go just to get his wife to shut up. And he never liked it, because he was like a businessman. He just loved doing business. That was his love of life, making money. And of course, if he had to go to the temple, it meant one day he had to close his shop. But when he went to the temple, he listened to the monk, and he said something which is, we all know, that your last thought is the most important. That will decide your rebirth. If you have a really beautiful last thought, then you maybe go to a heaven realm. If that's a bad thought, you go to a hell realm. So, when he heard that, he got interested. Is that all I need to do? Make sure my last thought is a good one? And then he heard the monk say that one of the best thoughts to have at the end of your life, as a Buddhist, is to remember the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha, to think of what they call the triple gem. And he thought, is that all I need to do? Just to think of Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, then I'll go to heaven. And the priest said, that's all you need to do. Great, he said. I don't need to make any more donations to these stupid monasteries. I don't need to keep any precepts. I don't need even to go to that temple anymore. All I need to do is to remember to think Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha as my last thought. So he said, how can I do that? And he had this insight, this stroke of genius. You know that sometimes you just see it? So when he went home, he had 3 sons. He renamed them. Eldest son, Buddha. Second son, Dhamma. And the third son, Sangha. Because he knows, it always happens. Your children are always there by your bedside when you're dying. So he said, that's way I'm sure I'll be able to think of the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha just before I die. So from that time on, he never gave any more donations. Doesn't matter how much his wife nagged him, he would not go to the temple, wouldn't keep any precepts. Because he had a plan. And it was working perfectly. At the end of his life, very old, and he was on his deathbed, and of course his children were by his side there. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. I'm going to heaven. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. I'm going to heaven. And just go close to his last breath, he kept reciting his three signs. He saw them there. He loved them to bits. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. And then he suddenly thought, hang on, if my three sons, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, are here, who's looking after my shop? And that's when he died. And became a hungry ghost, which... Because it's the whole inclinations of a lifetime. So just because you can't just suddenly think, okay, when I die, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, you can't do that. If you've been thinking of sex, booze, football all your life, that's what you're going to think when you die. It is said that we have to respect our parents because they have given us a chance to see the world. How about parents who abandon their children because they don't want them, or parents who abuse their children? Do the children still need to respect them no matter what? Are you supposed to respect monks and nuns? What about the bad monks and the bad nuns? One of the things is, it's like your parents. You respect the institution of a parent. Now, the very fact that, you know, they're what parenthood is. So you respect parenthood. So you respect monkhood. Because when I first became a monk, one of the hardest things for me to endure was people bowing to me. At least I thought that anyway. Because, you know, they bow to you in Thailand and say, look, bow to the Thai monks, don't bow to me. I'm a Westerner. You know, bow to someone else. And then one of the Thai people who could speak English said, look, they're not bowing to you, they're bowing to the robe. It's what you represent. That's what they're bowing. And I felt disappointed. I did have ego. That's a problem there. Mine is just really... So it's tough if your parents have misbehaved. And if they have actually abused you. But remember, just because they've abused you, they're not abusive. They're parents who've abused, they're not abusers. If you can remember that, they're bigger than those bad things, and that makes it possible to forgive them. And, you know, why did they do that? You know, sometimes, that you know, they've been put in impossible positions, I don't know. But sometimes it's so hard to judge when you don't really understand where people are coming from, why they're doing that. But it's tough anyway. My parents want me to work for them, to run the family business, but I don't feel like I'm going to be happy doing it. And my real passion is in other business, which I'm currently doing right now. My parents have been very upset towards me for not obeying them, and they thought and told me that I'm a bad child. What should I do? I've already explained to them the best I can, but they still can't accept it. Okay, it's the idea, the word of respect, you know, in Pali is called Garu Karoti. That's actually the word for respecting someone. And what it really means is making heavy. So what it really means to respect your parents means whatever your parents say is heavier than what other people say. It's got more weight to it. So when you make a decision, you put everything in the balance. So what your parents say, that's really important. That's heavy stuff. But it doesn't mean there's other things which can outweigh it. So respecting parents does not always mean doing what they tell you. And disobeying a parent is not respecting them. The Buddha disobeyed his parent and became a monk, ran away. And there's many other monks who disobeyed their parents in order to become monks. And some of the nuns as well. Your mothers wanted you to have grandkids. You say, no, I'll become a nun instead. So sometimes that it's not always doing what your parents say, but listening to what they say, giving it extra weight, more weight than others, and then you see what else you can put in the balances. And if the other things outweigh your parents, you have to respect that and not do what your parents say. And there's so many, this is especially in Malaysia and Singapore. I told this to the former chief priest in Brickfields, the late Dr. K. Sri Dharmananda, because I've been to Malaysia so many times. And I know that Malaysian parents are so happy and overjoyed when a young man becomes a monk, as long as it's not their son. Other people's son, yeah, but not my boy, not my girl. And I tell them, look, if you want to become, and I tell the people in Malaysia who want to ordain as monks and nuns, to please tell your parents that standing in the way of somebody doing something as wonderful and noble as becoming a monk is very, very bad karma. Stopping a child who really wants to become a monk or a nun, stopping them, that is very heavy bad karma. So out of respect for your parents, tell them, look, if you stop me, Mum and Dad, that's going to really hurt you. So I'm going to become a monk. I'm going to become a nun. Because that's what it means, stopping people doing good karma, doing something wholesome and nice, telling them not to give a donation, discouraging them from doing this or that. That is very, very bad karma. So I tell that to many parents, so they get a bit scared. So these days, their child said, I want to become a monk. Oh, please, please, please do it, do it, do it, do it. I can't stop you. Anything which is really good. Or, somebody wants to make a donation to a good cause. Your parents say, no, 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 don't do that. It's doing something good, kind. So you should really always encourage that. Next question. I sometimes lie to my parents because I think they have very weird, two-word advices in my life, such as, you take a taxi because it's dangerous. Or, you must take a taxi because it's dangerous. You might be kidnapped, etc. Or, you mustn't go out with your friends too much. Better stay with your family. And sometimes I break the rules, and when they ask me, I lie for doing such things. I really feel bad. What should I do? For your information, their minds and perceptions are impossible to be changed. Try to change it, and I'm grounded for life. Okay. Now, see if you can actually, get away without lying to them. Because it's not very nice to lie. So, take a taxi because it's dangerous. You might be kidnapped, etc. So, what you can do is you can take a taxi just to the corner of the street. And then you get out and walk. So, that way, your parents, they see you get in the taxi, they're happy. But, then you can get out and enjoy yourself. And it's not lying, as long as you don't tell them. Or, you mustn't go out with your friends too much. Better stay with your family. So how can you get around that? And what happened here, I remember I saw these girls in London recently, they were the daughter of a well-known Sri Lankan girl here. Their father died. Now, he was a really good friend. He died over here. So the mother was left with these two sons and two twin daughters. And I remember that, because he didn't really have any advice, he often came to me for, family advice. And she said, oh, my daughters, they're only 18, they want to go to the nightclub, and it's a really bad place, they have drugs there, they have alcohol. And I said, oh, come on, trust your children. They're good kids, they have to go to the nightclub, that's where all their friends are going, that's where they meet their friends, they meet their partner later on. Let them go, for goodness sake. So I taught the mother to let the kids go to the nightclub because she respected me. So they went out to the nightclub. They did really well, had a nice time. And one of them was a doctor. I forget what the other one is. They've done really, really good kids. Kids you could be proud of. And I say, you've got to give your kids some trust. And if you just keep them in because you're scared all the time, they never learn about life. In the end, they just run away anyway. I told this, that if you keep a bird in a cage, sooner or later, the door's going to be open, and it will fly away, and it will never come back. If you keep your kids like that, always telling them what to do, one day they'll leave, and they won't want to come back. But if you keep your kids in a cage with the door always open, they can fly in and fly out whenever they want. And as long as the cage is nice and comfy, and nice food, and nice bed, and stuff like that, they'll fly away, they'll always come back. So that's like looking after your kids. Don't put them in cages. Otherwise, when they leave forever. So be kind and give them a few breaks. Trust them, for goodness sake. And they'll always do the right thing. So what you should do, get a copy of this talk and give it to your parents. I'm stuck in a relationship where I don't really want to be with someone. But the thing is that someone told me that she will commit suicide if I break up with her. What should I do? Okay, look, find a nice replacement for her. See what Brad Pitt is doing. And say, look, I just got Brad Pitt, a blind date. Go out with Brad Pitt, not me. And then she won't commit suicide. No, that sometimes people always do those threats. And they never do them. So, yeah, you know, they make those threats, but they won't. So just I say, okay, you know, see if you keep your promises. They don't do it. Do you have to take precepts before you can call yourself a Buddhist? No. I was a Buddhist before I was keeping the precepts. But just you were aspiring to doing that. And later on, you know, after you were a Buddhist first, and then you were a precept, you kept your precepts. There was this guy, I really remember him. He was amazing that he was a drunkard, an alcoholic. But, you know, he was, because he had lots of, you know, social problems, emotional problems. But he was a very good Buddhist. And so for one rains retreat, he made a resolution. The resolution, he would not drink from sunrise to sunset. And it was really tough for him, but that's the best he could do. So he'd have the bottles ready, but not until that sunset went down. Then he'd get drunk, and he'd have a bit extra just before the sun came up, because it'd have to last him. But for the rest of the day, he had nothing at all. And he kept that promise for that 3 months. And he said that for him, that was a tough thing to do. So I respected him. Well done. It's encouraging. So you don't have to be perfect to be a Buddhist. What happens to mind when one suffers from dementia? I forget. Now what happens, it just gets dulled out. It goes into like a dark, sleepy state. So what happens to mind when you go to sleep at night? It just disappears for a while, but it comes back later on. So with dementia, for months, years, you go into this dull state, but then you come out again afterwards, at the end of your life, sort of, you know, you get your clarity again. Many, many times that's happened. And there's a case over here in Perth. It was actually a coma, not really dementia. Oh, was it dementia? I think it might have been. The two sisters, they were by their dad, who was dying. They were holding his hand. He'd been in a coma for a day or two. And just out of nowhere, he opened his eyes. You know, he bent up. He looked at his two daughters, and they said spontaneously, "We love you, Dad." And then he fell down and died. It's very often the case that the last few moments before you die are always clear. Even if you've got dementia, you may not remember anything for years. But then you see someone, "Hello, Phil." And then they die. The mind has been liberated from the brain. How to deal with people who are talking about stupid ideas, opinions which are not interested to me? Are you talking about me? No, it's because people like different things. Most people read an article or two, then talk like subject matter experts. If I show loving kindness or care, they will always come to me and waste my time. Thanks. I got to be kind sometimes. Look, if I thought like that, I would never sit in that chair and take interviews from you guys. So be kind to people, for goodness sake. So let them listen. Ajahn Chah told me that, you know, if you're going to be a friend to someone, you should be like dustbin. It's a dustbin simile. So you have to be the dustbin and take everybody's rubbish. So whoever wrote that, when people talk to you as if they're experts, let them dump on you, let them put things inside your dustbin. But he said the most important thing if you're a Buddhist is to be a dustbin with a hole in the bottom. So you keep nothing. So they can tell you all their problems, you listen to them, but you know, it goes right in, and when you get off that chair, you keep nothing. So you're always empty for the next person. Otherwise, you know what it's like if you listen to people, if you counsel them, because you care for people. Sometimes they put all their problems into you and they become your problems, and you worry about them. You carry somebody else's suffering around with you. That's really not fair. And it's actually pretty dumb to do things like that. So when you listen to someone you care about and they tell you all their problems, please remember, you are a dustbin. Accept their rubbish, their trash, but be a dustbin with a hole in the bottom so you keep nothing. And then you can be the great counselor. One last question. Can you please explain our reincarnation to the mind? Do meditators get good rebirth always? What happens to the mind in near-death experiences? How does the Dalai Lama choose his successor? By meditation or by other means? Reincarnation relating to the mind. Now remember, the mind is just a process. It's not a thing. It's totally changing. So the best simile is the simile of the mango. So you eat a mango today. You get the whole mango and you sort of carve it up and you put the seed in your garden. And you look after that seed. You see the seed splits and this little green thing comes out. And it grows and grows and grows and goes through the surface of the soil, becomes a little plant, and then it gets wooden, becomes a sapling, it gets bigger and bigger and taller and taller. Then it puts out its branches, it becomes a small tree, and then a bigger tree. And then the first time it has little flowers on the end of its branches, and the flowers become pollinated, and you get these little fruits. And the fruits grow, it becomes a mango, the mango gets ripe and just reddish. And you got your new ripe mango, and you taste that. Mmm, that's so delicious. What went from the first mango to the new mango? There's nothing which was in the first mango which is in the new mango. But there's a karmic connection there. That new mango is like a rebirth of the old mango. And you can actually see steps in the process. You see these links, and every second you can see the seed. You can see the seed splitting. You can see the little a shoot coming out, growing centimetre by centimetre by centimetre. You can see the whole process where it gets wooden on the outside, where it throws through branches and other twigs. You can see the process where it has the leaves and then the flowers, and then the flowers get pollinated. And you see a little fruit come at the top, at the bottom of the flower, and swirl and become the mango. You can see the whole process, the cause and effect. One cause, another effect, that's the cause for another effect. This whole process, whole link in the chain of causes. And that's just like you, your mind, this link of causes. You know, there's nothing in my mind now which was there when I was a kid, but I can actually trace back all the links to me as a kid. That's why the way the Buddha says, it's not the same, but not different. There's a linkage there. When you understand that linkage between moment to moment of your mind, you understand that that linkage is not suddenly stopping at death, but carries on. The mind is totally separate from the body. So the mind keeps evolving, just like the mango keeps evolving. And just like the mango, new mango, if the previous mango was very sweet, the new mango will be sweet. If the previous mango was like drought resistant, the new mango is drought resistant. You carry with you this karmic, these tendencies, which you built up over a previous time into this moment. So that's a simile of the mango. Nothing goes across, but there's still there's a connection. There's a link between this life and your last life. It's not the same, but there's a flow of causes, a linkage, a chain. That's what that is. Do meditators get good rebirth always? Of course not. Depends on how you meditate. If you meditate like this, you're not going to get meditation. What happens to mind in near-death experiences? It just leaves the body. It's the continuation of causes. It means the mind is outside of the body now. And it's very similar to what was there before. It's interesting that people who do see, you know, these people once they've just died, you know, the ghosts, they look exactly the same. This is one case, this builder, he lived in Kalgoorlie. That's, you know, just 300 miles to the east of here, mining town. He was a builder. He got cancer, quite bad cancer. He was dying. So his friend, who was living in Perth, said, you better go and see Ajahn Brahm. So he came to see me a couple of times. Really nice guy. I taught him a bit of meditation, but it's, you know, really too late. The meditation I taught him was just to be able to die well. And, you know, a few weeks later, he died in Kalgoorlie. So his friend, living here in Perth, flew over, you know, for the funeral, helped his wife out and everything. And then he came back to Perth. But, you know, the coffin was closed. That's an important point. So he never actually saw his friend because the wife said, no, I don't want anyone to see him. The coffin was closed throughout the whole funeral service. And he said, a few days later, he was at home, in bed at night, and his wife nudged him. At least that's what he thought. So he turned around and told his wife, said, "No, don't do that." His wife was fast asleep. It wasn't her. He turned around and it was mate who just died. It was a ghost. And he said, "This builder, he was wearing this nice suit and this polka dot tie." He said, "That's really weird. It's like an Australian builder, okay? They don't wear suits. Never. You know, they wear a little singlet and some shorts, and that's about it." And that really surprised him. And straight away, he turned around to his wife to wake her up. I think what his name was, like, "You know, Bill's here." And then when his wife woke up and they turned around, he was gone. He disappeared. So actually, it's really silly. They got up, out of bed. They started searching the house for the ghost. And you never find it. You only see it once. But what was really weird was that his friend was so strangely dressed in a suit and a polka dot tie. Oh, no, it's a bow tie. Polka dot bow tie. And so he came to see me and asked what's going on. I said, "Look, what you should do is, you know, a couple of days, just call the widow in Kalgoorlie and just have a little conversation. How are you going? Is everything going okay? You know, is you look being looked after?" And then in the middle of the conversation, just no mention, "Oh, by the way, now what was Bill wearing in his in the coffin?" And he did that, and of course he rang me afterwards, and he said, "You wouldn't believe this." And his wife said he was wearing a suit and a polka dot tie. He said, "You know, he would refuse to wear that throughout his whole life. I bought it for him, but I thought at least, you know, in his death, he could, you know, he could like look reasonable." And so his wife actually dressed him in his stuff he would never wore before. And that's actually how he saw the ghost. And so, you know, it was confirmation that was him, because he never expected to see him in that clothes. And that's actually what he was wearing inside the closed coffin. It's weird, isn't it? But that's why, how you die. So remember, when you die, be well-dressed, because you have to be like that for a few days. What happens to mind you? Okay. What happens to mind in near-death experience? I've mentioned that. How does the Dalai Lama choose his successor? By meditation or by other means? He doesn't really choose. He just foresees his successor, where he's going to be next time. So you have a vision, some sort of visions of what's going to happen in the future. That's what he does. But I've been told he's had enough already. So this is going to be his last time. I mean, imagine, is it the 14th Dalai Lama, isn't it? Imagine 14 times as a Dalai Lama. You really get fed up with it after a while. Now, being the President of the United States, and they only have 2 terms, they get fed up with it. Imagine 14 lifetimes as a Dalai Lama. Gee, that takes a lot of compassion. Anyway, there's many ones left here, but I have to wait till my next lifetime to answer some of these because there's too many of them. So anyway, that's enough for this evening. It's almost 9:30, but I started a bit late. And it's more so, can we have maybe a moratorium on questions tomorrow so I can answer these ones tomorrow night? Otherwise, what you can do, if you want to ask a question and you've already got a question inside here, find your old question, throw the old question away and replace it by a new one. So that way you can only have so many questions tomorrow, because this can take a long time to answer. Anyway, I did quite a few anyway. So, that's it for this evening, folks.